What's going on in the present affects our future, our tomorrows. Did you know that RUC provides help in preparing the tomorrows for our children? We're excited to invite you to the 15th annual RUC fundraising banquet on April 9th, where we'll present The Tomorrow Show. Our banquet will be held at the Villa Milano, with festivities beginning at 5:30, dinner is at 6:30, and the program gets underway at 7. Make your reservations today at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.
Do you understand the Electoral College? Find out how well today on Principles and Policies. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm your host here on Principles and Policies. And 2 weeks ago, I started a series on the Electoral College, trying to get people to understand why it's a really important safeguard in our electoral system. But we did skip a week to talk about relationships under construction and the upcoming banquet. This is our show, by the way, for April 6th. I somehow messed up really last week when I was talking about the dates, at least for when the show was going to run. But this is the show for April 6th, and our banquet is on April 9th. Well, you can count. Our banquet is on Tuesday, April 9th. This is the show is for April 6th, and I forgot to mention the year, 2024. And the banquet is April 9th, 2024. And I would ask you to go back and review that show last week. I still have a spot open at my table because one of the lovely ladies who comes and sits at my table just had to have some surgery done on her face, and she can't come. So I have two spots open. I may have one of them closed. Nonetheless, you out there in radio land can, in WLRY land, you can come and sign up at RUCinc.org or relationshipsunderconstruction.com. That's RUCinc.org or relationshipsunderconstruction.com. And you can sign up on the events choice, and you can come sit at my table. And if we run out of room at one table, we'll open another table and we'll split everybody up and we'll have a great time, because the RUC banquet is always a great time, and it's great time of learning about what it is that RUC does. So I would invite you, please come out to the RUC banquet April 9th at the Villa Milano in Columbus, Ohio. Again, you can check it out, RUCinc.org or relationshipsunderconstruction.com. All right, last week we left off on the Electoral College, and we were explaining part one, kind of went through the very basic ideas behind our form of government, and we did an explanation of what has changed in society and how we think about government and how we think about the executive portion of our government and that kind of thing. And we talked about all the things leading up to today. And today, last week, we kind of ended with what the founders expected to happen in the vote for the chief executive, the president, and what actually turned out to happen. So we'll kind of review that. I would invite you to go to www.principledpolicy.com, and you can review that first section. It's up there posted. I think the date is from March 23rd, because March 30th was our show for Relationships Under Construction. So March 23rd, you can go back and review that and get the opening part. Okay, let's dive right in, because I'll run out of time probably this week before I get finished. Now, on the first presidential election, and here's something, a little factoid. I'm going to throw in some factoids that you should know while we're doing this. On the first presidential election, in 1789, because that's when the Constitution got ratified, was finally ratified by enough states. Many of you may not know that when the Constitution went into effect, there were only 9 states in the Union. Now, we are all aware there were 13 states at the time, correct? But only 9 of them had ratified. Now, by the time it came to send electors to vote for the President of the United States in the Electoral College, and remember, you met in your state capitals to make those votes. That came out last week. And we talked about that section of the Constitution. In 1789, by the time George Washington was being elected president, there were only 11 states. And 2 of those states did not come in until George Washington had been president for some time. Rhode Island was the last one, and it didn't come in until George Washington had been in office for around 18 months. 16 or 18 months. The other one holdout was North Carolina. Those 2 states were not in the Union when George Washington was chosen. But in the Electoral College, when they designed it, and we talked about this, everyone expected one man to be the first president. Everybody. And George Washington was elected by a unanimous Electoral College vote, and he was reelected by a unanimous Electoral College vote. So his 2 terms were both unanimous. The consensus of opinion on what would happen after Washington. Now remember, there was unanimity on Washington, but there wasn't on who should be follow him. And George Mason basically said at the Constitutional Convention that, quote, 19 times in 20, the president would be chosen by the Senate. The way it works is the way this is before the system was fully worked out. Remember that there is a tie in the Electoral College. Where does it go? It goes to the House of Representatives. So, and the House votes, and each state, not each member, each state gets 1 vote. So in other words, all the representatives in a state caucus have to get together and choose who they are going to vote for in a tie. Now, it's become something else. That was the original design. Now you vote, we'll talk about, I talked about the 12th Amendment. That was all changed in the 12th Amendment. Okay, not to confuse the issue. Now, think about this. If every elector from each of the 13 states, and remember, these guys were not bound by party affiliation at that time. That's not what it was all about. It wasn't about party. It was about voting their conscience for who the best man for the job was. If every elector from each of the 13 states voted for the same home state favorite, that means someone from their home state, and 1 favorite from another state, because remember, the elector could not vote. He voted for 4 candidates, but he could only vote for 1 from his own state. How many candidates under these circumstances, 1 from his state and 1 from another state, at a minimum would receive electoral votes? And if the minimum number possible is 13, because each of the members from 13 states would vote for 1 home state favorite. That was the thought. And most likely it would be, you know, and then they voted for 1 favorite candidate from another state. Well, the minimum number would be 13. If you really think it through, the minimum number would be 13. Okay. What are the chances that 1 candidate would achieve a majority, that is 50% plus 1, not a plurality, 50% plus 1 of electoral votes under this model. Under that model, if you think about it and really put your thinking cap on and think about it, it would be very poor. Very poor. The chances of there being a majority would be terrible in the Electoral College. The framers believed that the Electoral College would provide a slate of the best candidates available. In other words, it was a winnowing process. They were kind of narrowing down the field from all these candidates. So the Electoral College, they thought, would narrow the slate. From that candidate slate, that narrowed candidate slate, the top five electoral vote getters are the list from which the House of Representatives must choose the president and vice president. Okay? They would have to choose from five candidates, five of the top vote getters in that Electoral College vote. The framers expected the House to choose the president in 19 times out of 20. So how'd that work out? In 1796, remember, this is after George Washington has retired. In 1796, Vice President John Adams got a majority of Electoral College votes in a field of 13 candidates. So out of 13 candidates, he got 50% plus one of the votes. Nobody expected that to happen. In 1800, okay, this is the next election. Vice President Thomas Jefferson defeated President John Adams with a majority of Electoral College votes in a field of four candidates. So already we narrowed down the fields from the expected 13 to four. Now, how could that possibly happen if everybody voted for a home state favorite? They didn't all vote for a home state favorite. Here's why. There were really two factions that came out of the Washington administration. Two factions. There were, you've heard these phrases, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. The Federalists kept the name. When parties formed up, the Federalists kept that party name. It wasn't a party at the time, it was a faction, a group that stuck together and had similar views and all that. The other faction was the Anti-Federalists. Well, they called themselves the Democrat Republicans, which sounds is a contradiction in terms for modern day, but this wasn't modern day, and the factions had already shown up, and so what had happened was John Adams sort of was too enamored of big government. And big government, boy, if we should have the big government of 1796. I'd like to go back to the big government of 1796. He liked the executive to have too much, what the Democrat Republicans thought was too much executive power and concentrating too much hands in the power in the hands of the federal government. So the Thomas Jefferson was espousing the opposite. He liked state sovereignty, and he liked smaller government, restricted government, and that was the constitutional interpretation. So these two factions came up over constitutional interpretation. Someday we'll go into the making of the Constitution, but today we're just talking about the Electoral College. Okay, so in a field of four candidates, which means that people from numerous states voted for one person rather than a home state favorite. Okay. None of this was expected to happen. The only time the system worked the way the framers envisioned it, with the Electoral College providing a list of candidates with the top three, which was, again, we changed it with the 12th Amendment from the top five. Those candidates going to the House of Representatives for their choice was in the election of 1824. And Andrew Jackson got the majority of popular votes. But it was all a tie in the Electoral College, a three-way tie, or there were pluralities of electoral votes. There weren't majorities. Therefore, it had to go to the House of Representatives, and they chose John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson and William Crawford. You've probably never heard of William Crawford. He's obscure now, but he wasn't at the time. He was quite well known. We all know who John Quincy Adams was. He was John Adams' son, and he was a genius, a brilliant man. We all know who Andrew Jackson is. And Andrew Jackson was hopping mad over this. And because of the things he did between 1824 and 1828, remember, we'd already talked about those factions having formed. Andrew Jackson and his vice president in 1828, Martin Van Buren, formed what amounts to today the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party grows out of Andrew Jackson's efforts between 1824 and 1828 to make sure that he didn't get robbed of the presidency again. There was a hue and cry because he got the majority of votes, but he didn't get the majority of Electoral College votes. Now, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I would much rather have seen, the original system. However, I think personally that the formation of political parties was inevitable. It's been inevitable wherever you've got an electoral system. People will band together with certain interpretations and certain ideologies regarding policy, and they will stick together. And there will be people that have the opposite idea or a very dissimilar idea, and they will stick together as a party. And that's exactly what happened. The opposition party became, you may have heard of this group, the Whigs. The Federalists broke apart essentially as a coalition during the War of 1812 for a number of reasons. We won't go into that, but nonetheless, we know that the two parties were set by the 1828 election. Okay. Nonetheless, how'd that affect the Electoral College? Well, we had only a very few ties, Electoral College ties, since that time, or where the majority vote winner did not become the president, but they're always contentious. Okay. The 12th Amendment, we talked about this, how it changed it, whittled the candidate pool down to three from five that went from the Electoral College vote to the... it also encouraged this formation of parties because all of a sudden, the Electoral College was not just voting for their top five favorite candidates. They were voting for specifically a president and a vice president. Before this, the one who got the second highest vote in the Electoral College became the vice president. What that led to was, for instance, Thomas Jefferson was John Adams' vice president. Ideologically, they were not the same. So you had the vice president, who was then president of the Senate, if you understand how our government works. The vice president, Thomas Jefferson, who was vice president of the Senate. And there's reasons for that, why he's president of the Senate. And John Adams, who had very differing policies. Very differing policies, who were in opposition to each other. Thomas Jefferson, I remember the vice president is a presiding officer. He is president of the Senate. What does that mean? That means he has the chair. Does it mean necessarily that he runs the place? No, he has influence, but he is more of a parliamentary head. He doesn't vote except in a tie. So you may have heard occasionally in the Senate you'll get a 50-50 tie. And who has to break it? The vice president. The vice president only has a vote if there's a tie. Okay, so now in the Electoral College, they've gone, after the 12th Amendment, they've gone from voting just for their top five choices. They're now voting for a specific set of president and vice presidents. Very profound change, because now they're running as a team, so that someone of the same faction can then run the Senate with the president. And remember, this was quote unquote supposed to make government more efficient. Folks, what you don't want, really, 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 what you don't want, and I know people are going to make fun of me, and I'm going to hear about this, and if you want to, you know, chairman@principledpolicy.com, that's chairman@principledpolicy.com, send me an email. Again, chairman@principledpolicy.com, and explain your objections to that. You really want government to work as inefficiently as possible, because the whole idea behind the way this government is designed is to slow things down so people have time to contemplate. Every time we ram something through on the quick and everybody's very interested in getting this and that and another thing done, and we have it turns into a nightmare. And I can't think of a single time when it hasn't turned into a nightmare. Now, you may be able to. And if you can, chairman@principledpolicy.com. Or go to the website and look me up, principledpolicy.com. Okay. That being said, we see a fundamental change in the way the Electoral College now works. The electors vote for a president and a vice president. All right. Then, you know, it does the same. It all goes to the House of Representatives if there's a tie. And then the 12th Amendment talks about when the president will be inaugurated. We changed all that during Franklin Roosevelt's term. It went from March to January. In the old days, sometimes the president, remember, we've had this president would be elected president and he wouldn't know about it for months because it took the mails that long to make their way. And then this candidate had to make his way to the operating capital. Remember, the capital did not become the capital until Washington, D.C., I think Jefferson's first term, Washington's first two terms, it was in Philadelphia and New York. So it went to D.C., I think, for the 1800 election, I think. I have to check that out. Nonetheless, it took time. You know, you didn't just hop a train and go. You had to get on a horse or take a carriage, and it could take weeks to get to Washington, D.C., depending on where you lived. And then you had to get your notification by mail that you'd been elected first, and that could take weeks. So the inauguration used to be on March 12th. Now it's in January 20th. Okay. Okay. After the 12th Amendment, electors still vote for two candidates, but now they designate one as president and one as vice president. And if the Electoral College fails to provide a majority, the top three then go to the House instead of the top five. Okay. Why was the change? Factions developed, as we talked about, in Washington's cabinet that grew into political parties. There was intrigue in the Electoral College. In the elections of 1796 and 1800, factional schemes were devised in an attempt to keep certain persons from getting enough Electoral College votes to be elected. This led to all kinds of mayhem. There were people who couldn't stand one another, who knew they would be facing other people, and so they worked into these schemes. And I'm laughing, but it's not funny, because it actually led to a duel, a famous duel, as part of the not entirely the cause, but partly. The electoral crisis nearly created a constitutional crisis in 1800. In a coordinated effort to ensure a single party would control both the presidency and vice presidency, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr both received a majority of electoral college votes, and each got an equal number of votes. Okay? So in 1800, it was Burr versus Jefferson. Because the original electoral system was still in place, a majority tie vote before the 12th Amendment, a majority tie vote with no designation of the candidate's office sent the choice for president to the House of Representatives for the tiebreaker. The House was in the hands of Federalists, but both Jefferson and Burr were Democrat Republicans. You may not know that. Aaron Burr was a Democrat Republican, and Jefferson... he and Jefferson were both, although they were not friendly. There was so much debate and intrigue in the House, some Federalists even threatened to defy the Constitution and put a Federalist in the president's office. Remember, they had to vote from the top five, and in this case, there was a tie. Some Federalists supported Burr because they thought he was the worst possible candidate. Where have we heard that before? How many times have we talked about in these primary elections that are open? I personally am against open primaries. I used to be for them. Now I'm against them for this reason. People will come from another party, will come over and vote for the worst possible candidate in hopes that that person will be the choice for that state. Some states, they were coming over and voting for Nikki Haley, and we know that for a fact. That's an undeniable fact in the primaries in the spring and late winter, early spring. There were people in open primary states who were coming over to vote for Nikki Haley. Why? To monkey wrench Donald Trump. They thought if enough could come over, then they could trip up Donald Trump. Okay, the House required 36 ballots and a week's work to pick Jefferson over Burr, and it wasn't quite that simple. There was a lot of lobbying going on, a lot of people wringing their hands and begging and pleading and political threats and all kinds of stuff going on, but it required 36 ballots. Okay. Now, who was responsible for breaking the tie? Alexander Hamilton. Remember I talked about the duel, the famous duel? What was the famous duel? Hamilton versus Burr. Hamilton and Burr were mortal enemies. Literally mortal enemies. Hamilton didn't like Jefferson, but he despised Aaron Burr. Despised. That's why they went to a duel. They were also both from New York. This was New York politics playing out, state politics. Hamilton also despised John Adams, who was a fellow Federalist. So remember, Alexander Hamilton was a Federalist. Aaron Burr was a Democrat Republican. And Hamilton published a pamphlet that helped defeat Adams in the 1800 election. Hamilton had devised a scheme in the 1796 election that was designed to defeat both Jefferson and Adams, and it failed. Remember, Hamilton was not eligible to run for president, and the reason he was not eligible to run for president was he was born on a Caribbean island. He was born on Nevis and St. Kitts, and was not a natural born citizen. So he was ineligible to run for president. So he chose to be a manipulator behind the scenes. So this is part of that manipulation. Alexander Hamilton broke that tie. The 12th Amendment was a concession to faction in the form of party politics. We already talked about that. Having a president and vice president from different parties was frustrating to some of the Federalists, who wanted a very strong chief executive. And that was part of John Adams' issue. Because a vice president from the other party could frustrate the president's legislative agenda. To be fair, the Democrat Republicans did not trust the Federalists either. So, again, we're already into that party faction. Every action has consequences. We know this. Every action has consequences. What were the consequences for the changes of the 12th Amendment? The individual parties could now run teams of candidates to ensure unified government, quote unquote. How many times have we heard that? Unified government is basically both parties want to have single party rule. Is that a good thing? No, it's not. Unified government is a euphemism for institutionalized faction, which is also a term for institutionalized parties. All you have to do is look at states where that have one party rule, essentially. California, New York. It's not completely one party. There are elected representatives, but they're a majority and have been for decades. It's not a pretty sight. Political parties didn't work then like they work now. This is an important consideration. Parties began as caucuses of officials who share a common vision of economics, constitutional interpretation, and foreign policy. Federalists in general believed in strong centralized federal authority. Diminished state authority, a central bank with the power to fund internal improvements. At the time, what would have internal improvements meant? Canals. This is why George Washington, in part, was a Federalist. He was sickened by what happened to him and his army during the Revolution, where the states kind of sometimes refused to send things that they already had to the army so they could defeat the British. It was a little too much state, too much state autonomy in his view. And he liked the central bank and he liked internal improvements. Why? Because he was a surveyor and he owned a lot of land in the West and he wanted to be able to build canals for people to get out and buy the land that he owned in the West. It turned out in the end that a lot of that land was stolen by squatters. And a lot of that was in the Kanawha Valley in West Virginia and Maryland and Western Pennsylvania. He sided with Federalists. Interestingly, this is one of those factional things. Federalists sided with the Royalists in the French Revolution, and Democrat Republicans sided with the revolutionaries in the French Revolution. Interesting little tidbit. You have to know more about the French Revolution to really grasp what was happening there, but. Democrat Republicans in general believed in a decentralized, diminished federal authority, disliked federal control of the economy through the national bank. They wanted local banks and local currencies, and for those currencies, according to the Constitution, to not they wanted those local currencies to be recognized as legal tender in all states. That's hence the Constitution. They didn't like the financing of internal improvements with government money and sided with the revolutionaries in the French Revolution. We already mentioned that. parties begin to present slates of electors committed to specific candidates. Candidates no longer chosen by electors on the basis of their judgment of the individual candidate's merit. That was the original plan. Candidates are chosen in caucuses of party leaders, and electors were pledged to vote for these candidates. So whichever party was in control of the state legislatures. That's who, that's the slate that they would choose. Election procedures and eligibility of voters began to change. Again, inevitably. In 1789, no citizen except electors voted in a presidential election. No, you didn't go vote for president. Your state legislature did that. And some state legislatures continued to do that up to, and I think a little bit after, the war between the states. In 1792, only 6 of 15 states. Remember, this is, you figure the first president, 1789. In 1792, only 6 of 15 states had any form of popular vote for presidential election. In 1792, there were 13,000 popular votes cast. Doesn't sound like a lot, does it? It's not, because less than half the states did that. Most electors were chosen by state legislatures, and in states with popularly elected electors, they are mostly chosen by congressional district. In other words, the electors were chosen by congressional district, not by number of popular votes. Most electors were still uncommitted. That's 1792. In 1796, only 9 of 15 states had any popular vote for president. Remember, this is when they're starting to get contentious. 1792 was Washington's re-election. 1796 was John Adams. There are now electors chosen under the banner of party now, though, in 1796. And there were about 67,000 popular votes cast, up from 13,000. So that's what, five times almost? Not quite. Only 9 of 15 states. So we're now over half. In 1800, only 6 of 16 states had any form of popular vote in a presidential election. And there were about 67,000 popular votes cast. Again, 67,000. But we have now gone from 13 states to 16 states. In 1804, 11 of 17 states had popular vote for president, and about 143,000 popular votes were cast. Suffrage requirements becoming less restrictive. What does that mean? Suffrage, the vote. Not suffer, suffrage. Remember, I always, when I was a young man and I didn't know the words, why is it considered suffering to vote, have to vote? No. Suffrage. In 1808, the next election, only 10 of 17 states had any popular vote for president. So actually one state took it away. About 193,000 popular votes cast. Remember, it's becoming less and less of a restriction to vote popularly for president. In 1812, only 9 of 18 states had popular vote for president. Okay, we've gone back another one. We've gone down one, but the number of states have increased. But in 1812, there were 279,000 popular votes cast. So the number goes up, even though the number of states choosing electors that way goes down. In 1816, remember, this is after the War of 1812. This is just after the War of 1812. In 1816, only 10 of 19 states had any popular vote for president. And interestingly, only about 113,000 popular votes cast. I'm not sure why. There had to be a reason. But again, we're down to just over half the states allow popular voting for president. In 1820, only 15 of 24 states, and we're up to 24, had popular vote for president, but only about 108,000 popular votes were cast. Again, the voting has become more restrictive. Now, this is the year, 1820. when James Monroe, the only other president who would have been elected by a unanimous Electoral College vote, he got 99.5% of the Electoral College vote. And that's because somebody, one of the electors said, nope, we need George Washington to remain the only unanimous guy. So in 1824, this is the election we talked about earlier, the tie election. 18 of 24 states had popular vote for president, but now all of a sudden, 366,000 popular votes. Why is that? That is because a number of states are beginning to elect, and populism is beginning to become a thing. Andrew Jackson was a war hero, War of 1812, Battle of New Orleans, we've all heard the song. The Battle of New Orleans that was won several weeks after this treaty was already signed, but again, because the mails move slowly, and New Orleans is so far distant from the Washington, D.C. and the center of government, they didn't know the war was over. So they fought the decisive battle after the war was already won. But populism's becoming a thing, 366,000 popular votes cast. By 1828, this is the one where party had begun to rear its ugly head. Only two states had no popular vote for president. So see what I'm saying about populism? We went from 18 of 24 states, which means six, didn't have popular vote. And all of a sudden, by 1828, we had only two states, and there were 1.15 million popular votes cast in 1828. So populism and the popular vote is becoming a big thing. After being a relatively small thing for the first 30 odd years of the of the Republic. The election of 1828 is the turning point in presidential elections. It really is the turning point. Political parties in full control of presidential elections at the state and federal level. Parties now pander to and try to manipulate popular opinion. Emotional issues begin to dominate presidential politics. Ladies and gentlemen, these are facts. No longer are we talking about people, the best man for the job. We're talking about the guy who can drum up the most support. And Andrew Jackson was a master of this, and so was Martin Van Buren, who, by the way, became president. In 1828, demagogic politicians began to whip regional disagreements. Remember, this is where regionalism comes in, into major policy splits. Political campaigns under the control of party machines created increasingly strident and dirty campaigns. The presidential election of 1828 becomes one of the nastiest campaigns in presidential history. It really was. The men chosen as electors have passed from independent thinking men interested in choosing whom they believe will be the best president to party operatives with the party's interest as their chief concern. Most states now have popular voting, what they call general ticket voting, for president, with the highest vote getter getting all the state's electoral votes rather than the winner of each individual congressional district's vote. We've gone from this by congressional district to winner take all. This is in as far back as 1828. Between 1789 and 1828, the nation undergoes a rapid shift of political philosophy, and that's true. For those of you yearning for the good old days, we've been in this mess for quite some time. The underlying principle has changed from liberty to the spirit of democracy. The nation's religious foundation shifts from a strong reform theological influence to strong Enlightenment Unitarian influence. Part of this has to do with the Second Great Awakening, and there are a number of things that are going on. There is the Reformed are coming under a more liberal influence of the Unitarians, and it's floundering a bit. In the eyes of many, God is no longer sovereign, enlightened man is. So the Enlightenment is rearing its ugly head, just as it did in France with the Revolution. Between 1789 and 1828, the nation undergoes a rapid shift of political philosophy. The election of 1828 and the fundamental changes to the way people think about and the way states choose electors is the first step in dismantling federalism. That's right. These ideas dismantle federalism, the idea of state sovereignty, and begin to coalesce as this one nation idea. Because under the old way of thinking, we were nations united under a common federal banner. We were independent nations united under a common banner, and now we're beginning to think in terms, some at least, especially in the North, are beginning to think in terms of one nation. Federalism is a uniquely Republican system which can be described as divided sovereignty. Divided sovereignty keeps government small. United sovereignty allows the government to grow. That means that each divided sovereignty means that each individual division of civil government, national, state, local, individual, has specific areas of jurisdiction and that the others cannot encroach on. In other words, there are specific spheres of sovereignty. Any of you that are familiar with Abraham Kuyper understand the idea of sphere sovereignty. If you're not, go find a book by Abraham Kuyper. There are several where he talks about sphere sovereignty, he will help you to understand this idea that national, state, local, and individual governments are not supposed to encroach on their areas reserved for one another. Those of you who have listened to my God and Government series that I did a couple of years ago, this is a big deal. We talked about this extensively. Go back in the archives at principledpolicy.com and listen to the, I think I did three shows. I'm probably going to do more. I will link those all up in a series, but sphere sovereignty is the big idea here. But each of these smaller units of civil government voluntarily agrees to delegate some of their authority to the higher authority for the good of the smaller unit. In other words, we don't do all of our self-defense ourselves. We do some of it, but some of it we delegate to the local sheriff, who then agrees to protect us. He's supposed to agree to protect us, and he's supposed to intercede for us if one of the other sovereignties, one of the other higher sovereignties, attempts to usurp our own authority in our home and on our property. The original intent of the Constitution is for a federal republic. The genius of the American Republic is that it is both representative and federal. All of the units of government are represented in the higher units that they have helped create. All right? That's the original plan. How do I mean that? There are strong objections to representation in presidential choices. The country divides along regional, economic, and philosophical lines. That's inevitable. We have more in common with the Midwest than we do with the Northeast, than we do with the Southwest, than we do with the Far West, than we do with the Middle West. Midwest, meaning Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota. We have more in common with them than we do with, you know, beyond the Dakotas, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, those kind of, and the Southwest, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, and the South, all those things. In the election of 1860, this is where a lot of this philosophy change comes to a head, and it's a big head, obviously. The Republican Party candidate, Abraham Lincoln, does not appear on 11 Southern state ballots. Okay, why not? Well, because the Republican Party chose not to run Abraham Lincoln in those 11 Southern states, knowing full well they all it was a essential lead pipe cinch that they will achieve zero electoral votes by doing that, by running him there, and that at the time the parties funded their places on the ballot, and they didn't want to waste the money. Why waste the money on a candidate who's going to garner a few thousand popular votes? And achieve no electoral advantage. Now, the opposition in that in the Democratic side is split three ways, but more alike in agenda with each other than with the Republicans. And what does that mean? You've got three. You've got the Democratic Party. You've got the what was the name of the. There were three different parties, they were more Democrat than Republican. So these were born largely out of splits. If you ever read what happened with the Democrats, how they split, people would split off and go form a rump during the conventions. The conventions were simply a shambles on the Democratic side. And these three factions came out of it, and they each ran candidates. In that election, Lincoln got 40% of the popular vote, but 60% of the Electoral College vote. And, of course, within weeks, the war between the states starts. Remember, 60% of the popular vote went to people who would, in any other situation, be referred to as Democrats. Are we really, really, really divided at this time? Oh, way more. We're beginning to look like this. We are really, really, really in this country starting to look like emotions are running high, people are factionalized, there are splits within parties. We really are in a mess right now, and this is very much what it looks like. The election of 1876, okay, the centennial, the 100-year anniversary of the beginning of the Revolution, of our independence, 1776. The election of 1876 is probably the most corrupt election in American history. I'll be quite honest, it's pretty corrupt. It makes the horribly corrupt election of 2020 look squeaky clean. This election is all virtually certainly stolen from popular vote winner Samuel J. Tilden. This is why the first week I asked if you've ever heard of Samuel J. Tilden. And the answer is you probably never have. He was the he got the popular votes, but there were there was major fraud by both major parties, Democrats and Republicans. There was exclusion of black voters by Southern Democrats. So black voters were physically and very often violently kept from voting by Southern Democrats. Black voters were shuttled around to multiple Southern precincts by occupying federal troops, who then were led to vote Republican in 1876. Multiple Electoral College slates were certified by rival election officials in contested states. And if I remember right, states like Louisiana and like Oregon, I think Oregon sent three electoral slates, three different slates of electors to vote in their state capitals. And I think Louisiana had two or three as well. This was not an isolated incident. There's a great book called The Stolen Election. I can't think of the name of the author. I have a copy of it. And it talks kind of exclusively about this election and shows you just how awful it can be and how it can get and how close we came to being that awful in 1820. The election was certainly stolen. The whole reason that Mike Pence and Donald Trump split was because Mike Pence somehow got into his head that the Senate couldn't refuse to certify the votes. He's wrong. They could have, and they could have sent it back to the states and said, "Okay, clean up this fraud," and then sent it back to us. He chose not to do that. Why? Because he's a coward. My personal opinion. All right. This, in 1876, led to an unconstitutional intrusion of the federal government into the Electoral College results. Congress created a, quote, electoral commission, a federal electoral commission, consisting of 8 Republicans and 7 Democrats. Why? Because the Republicans were in the majority in the House of Representatives. The Electoral Commission wrested control of the appointment of electors from state control. So in other words, they didn't force the states to fix their problems. They just simply said, "We're taking over here." There's no constitutional mandate for that. Electors were awarded to Hayes, Rutherford B. Hayes, who became the president instead of Samuel J. Tilden, on the basis of a deal with Democrats to end Reconstruction in the South. If you've ever, go back in history, Reconstruction was ended in 1877. It was ended that way because of this deal. The purpose of the Electoral College is to provide proportional representation. Why does it really matter? You know what? I'm going to have to end. I've got more stuff to go. I'm out of time. We will go back next week and do a review, because I'll listen and make sure there are areas I wasn't confusing in. And I'm sure I was, because this is a complex topic. I'll review next week, and we'll go into why the Electoral College still matters, because it does. All right, that being said, hey, join us on April 9th for Relationships Under Construction, the banquet at Villa Milano, starting at 5:30. RelationshipsUnderConstruction.com or RUCInc.org. And if you know what I think, and I want to know what you think, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join me next week for another Principles and Policies.
What's going on in the present affects our future, our tomorrows. Did you know that RUC provides help in preparing the tomorrows for our children? We're excited to invite you to the 15th annual RUC fundraising banquet on April 9th, where we'll present The Tomorrow Show. Our banquet will be held at the Villa Milano, with festivities beginning at 5:30, dinner is at 6:30, and the program gets underway at 7. Make your reservations today at relationshipsunderconstruction.com.